This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
And I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, this week recorded live from London. So, as is hopefully obvious from the different intro there, this is the episode with our first live show recording in it. But before we get into that, we've got our usual intro with Danielle and I. We'll get into how well the live show went and a bit of information about today's theme, which is recovery. So, first off, I've got some general information about recovery from the Mental Health Foundation. So, I'll just read that now. In mental health, recovery may not always refer to the process of complete recovery from a mental health problem, in a way that we may recover from a physical health problem. Recovery can instead mean different things to different people. However, for many, recovery is about the realization of goals and the development of relationships and skills that support a positive life, with or without ongoing mental health problems.
Yeah, I quite like that because it aligns to the individual, you know, about the skills, and it really highlights the fact that recovery isn't one thing for everybody. What you might need to do to recover is different for one person from the other. I like that because I don't think everybody quite always recognises that in recovery, that are you recovered or not is not black and white.
Yeah, definitely. I really love that. And it is annoying at times when there's this constant comparison of mental health and physical health. I'd sort of like to get to a point where we don't have to use physical health to explain mental health anymore.
Yeah.
But for now, it is a really good way of contrasting it, the sort of more non-linear recovery that can take place with mental illness. And that definitely comes across talking to the guests at the live show as well, that we've all had different journeys and feel recovered to different extents. And that's the process. If we can focus instead on that and recovering well, as opposed to only like a finite goal of this is the amount we should be recovered, otherwise we've failed, I think that's a lot healthier, particularly for certain conditions we cover in the episode, like addiction. The beating yourself up for not feeling recovered enough could easily be a reason to use again, that you feel like you're failing anyway, so you just think, well, scrap it. I'll just go back on whatever I was taking.
Yeah.
So I really like that. And it's not exactly a definition, but it's a really good way of describing recovery. They actually go on to say that while there is no universally accepted definition of recovery, one often used is referred to as the recovery model, which argues for the importance of building the resilience of people with mental health problems and supporting their identity and self-esteem. So it's a lot broader of how this person can be empowered. And that's really what we try and do here at the show.
Absolutely love that. That's what I'm all about, 100%. And again, it aligns with our amazing campaign about mental health education, because it is all about that, understanding that.
I love that you always get a plug in for that.
I do. So it all comes back to it. All the time when we walk, everything comes back to that. Those early years, understanding who we are, starting to build some awareness of our identity, some self-awareness, building resilience around other things that are going on in the outside world. And that is where, to me, the learning and the strength will come from. Recovery in itself, I think we're all in recovery most of the time. Like, I don't know how much, as you said before, that finite, how much of us are recovered, really, ever, and then that's it. Like, I don't know.
I think it can be quite freeing to not look at it in that binary sense. Not only is it more accurate, but also then you may beat yourself up less if you have a relapse. You know, that actually that is very much part of the journey, and that's certainly what I found and what all the guests in today's episode have experienced, the ebb and flow of recovery. And by acknowledging that, you can see that having blips along the way is actually part of the process and not an inherent failure in you.
Oh, 100%. We could just go on and on and on. I could talk about this topic forever, but I absolutely agree. The ebb and flow, that is the whole thing. We're up and we're down. I always remember my dad saying to me once, never get too high and never get too low. And I always love that because things change all the time. And it's exactly the same with our mental health. You know, when we're feeling really great, that's really great. Enjoy that and be in the moment. But don't let that be the whole, I'm great now, I'm done. Because there's a slope that we might slide back down. And if we do, as just as you've said, Bobby, that's fine too. We'll learn. It's fluid all the time. You know, and I absolutely, I really held on to that. I really held on to that. And it, as I said, it was a winning or losing moment that he said it to me. But it's the same in I think you can really relate it to this conversation too.
Definitely. It comes back to you are enough, the thing I say at the end of every episode.
Yeah.
And one thing people will know that came along to the live show is in the Q&A section where people wrote down questions and Danielle read them out to me and the guests. That was one where I kind of cheated. Because we had a question about what's the best thing somebody has said to you in terms of your mental health recovery. And I cheated because I use something I say to myself, which is you are enough. And
yeah.
And for me, that links in so closely that you can be at any point and be enough and be doing well for where you're at. There's no such thing as perfection. There is no end point in life or in mental health, and therefore you have to find ways to be happy with the place that you're at.
Absolutely.
So that's one of the many extra things you'll get from coming along to a live show. So if you did come along to this one, thank you so much for being there. It was so wonderful meeting our listeners, getting to know you guys, hearing about how mental fits into your days and your routines, and how you've found it helpful. That's really what we're here for. But also hopefully this episode being released will motivate even more people to come along to the next one. So there is things like the Q&A section where we put questions to the guests and to me, which isn't included in this release today. There's also a full live performance. This time the show was closed out by Charles Edison, so we're including one track recorded from his live set at the end of this episode, which you'll hear after the interview portion. But he did actually perform five, and it was incredible and so moving.
Absolutely incredible. And you're absolutely right, anybody who didn't come, get down to the next one, because it is more than just the episode. The whole event was just, you know, from the beginning to the end, everybody was just connected. We were just all there in that moment together. And as you said, the questions and answers, the music, everything just really fit so well. It was a really amazing event, an amazing space, really, really good. And I'm not just saying that I'd come. If I wasn't co-hosting the show, I would be there, as so were many of my friends. But I just think it was brilliant. So, yeah, I really do urge people to get down and to the next one. It's fab.
Yeah, definitely. There was a realness to the event that people really appreciated. And I think so often with our modern social media world, that can be removed. So it was really lovely to be in a space where our guests are feeling empowered to share so openly. And, you know, people are writing down questions for them. And there's that real interaction and truth coming out that people really connect to. And so wonderful to hear how much people got from it, how inspiring and motivational they found what was at times a really emotive conversation.
I was really moved actually by the whole thing, and it was funny. I mean, it was hilarious at times. We did have so much fun. The audience were laughing, or, you know, it was great. And that adds to the realness of it. It was just actually moving and uplifting and funny and real, as you said. And that made it so good. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
I go on about it all the time.
I had a lot of fun. And I think that actually comes across listening to it back, that I sound different because I'm enjoying it so much. Like, it's not, of course, I enjoy every interview. I really do love doing this work, but
on the stage with three guests.
Yeah, but the excitement, there was an electricity to it that's different to, you know, recording when it's just a few of us. It was surreal, actually, because there was times when I was sat there, you know, listening to the guests answer my questions and wondering, like, oh, I hope the audience is enjoying it. And then someone would say something funny and they'd all instantly laugh. And I was like, oh, they're all super engaged. And that was really great.
Yeah.
So with that all said, we'll get into the live recorded interview in a moment, followed by a track performed live from Charles Edison called No Likes. But first... Who's our sponsor? Let's find out. First up, a campaigner. She does talks in schools. She campaigns for the weight restrictions to be taken out of eating disorder support because they come in all shapes and sizes, as we'll discuss. It is the wonderful Hope Virgo. I slightly lost momentum in that intro because I was like, I need to get her petition right.
Oh no, it was perfect. I just was kind of dithering backstage on my phone.
Cool. You feeling ready?
Yeah.
All right. And next up, we've got, he's a YouTuber, he's a musician, he's just released an EP all about mental health through his music, which is pretty incredible. It's Byron Langley. Hello. I'm doing sentimental clapping. This makes no noise. I'm being supportive. And finally, he's our musical performer to close out the show. He's a rapper. He's a producer. I earlier told him he makes music with computers, and it blows my mind. It's Charles Edison. I'm going to pour myself some water. We had backstage, we had little cans of water, and they pop when you open them. They're still, I don't understand it. Okay, so we'll begin. So this episode is all about recovery. If you've listened to the... Who's not listened to the show before? Okay, so you're all mute now. It's like the reverse thing. It's like now you know we're coming to the recorded bit. Now none of you want to be on the show. I get it. If you've listened to the show before, you'll know we do a theme every time. This theme is recovery. Normally, I just have one guest. Today, we have three. So I'm going to be doing my best to like mediate them. I've interviewed Hope and Charles before. So hopefully, I know enough about you guys. We've done our research. So to start off with, I'll get you each to introduce yourself by name and then a bit of background on where your mental health journey began. And then we'll go to the next person.
So hi, my name's Hope Virgo, and I developed anorexia when I was about 12 years old. When I first developed the anorexia, it was a complete and utter coping mechanism to life. It was like having this best friend in my head constantly telling me what I should be eating, what I should be doing, and it gave me this real sense of purpose and value every single day, giving me that sense of control, but also helping me to just switch off from everything around me. I ended up being admitted to hospital when I was 17 and spent a year recovering, and I'm now in like an ongoing state of recovery. So knowing what my triggers are, knowing what I need to do every day to kind of stay well and able to manage it now in a healthy kind of positive way.
Thank you.
Awesome. Hey, my name is Byron. So my mental health journey began when I was 16 years old. I lost my dad, unfortunately, to cancer, which was quite a blow to a teenager. And the results of that afterwards were quite hard to deal with. It was weird because when he died and at his funeral and everything, I didn't cry. I didn't really feel anything, which was kind of the thing I had to deal with the most, was just a feeling of just kind of nothing. Off the back of that, I developed quite an addiction, mainly to marijuana, which is kind of weird because the stigma around it is that it's not addictive. But let me tell you something, that is addictive. And then, yeah, I've just been on the road to recovery. Things have been a lot better over the last few years. So, yeah, it's pretty much me.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Charles. Yeah, I think mine started probably about 8 years ago. I was diagnosed with depression, but I had a really bad drug abuse problem. And I can't really remember what came first, but whether it was the depression or the drug use, but it's hard because they sort of feed into each other. And then sort of culminated in a, obviously, failed suicide attempt. And I went to rehab for 3 months. That was 3 years ago, and I've sort of stayed clean and sober since. So, yeah.
Great, thank you. I love the such diverse perspectives we've got there. But even within that, there's such similarities. Because particularly for, I feel like, eating disorders and addiction, there's a level of controlling there, that it's an unhealthy coping mechanism to help you feel more in control of your life. Do any of you want to share how it was as something you were using to try and cope?
Yeah, I think, like you said, they worked hand in hand. So it was kind of, you thought it was a plaster that you're putting over what you're trying to cope with, but it's not. It's just a full stop. And in order to actually make any progress, that was the first thing that I felt necessary to cut out was drugs in general. It made a huge difference. And you think in your mind you're feeling better by taking these things, but by no way are you feeling any better. They like work hand in hand. You think, oh, it's helping because yesterday was fine, but now tomorrow is a completely different story, and there's just no linear progress being made at all. It's just a scramble.
Yeah, and I guess with you experiencing this around grief, you weren't grieving at the time.
No.
And so essentially taking a substance that helps you feel more numb would have felt quite safe, right?
Yeah, I think that's why I sort of was magnetized to it, is because it was a way of just feeling numb. It was a way not to think about anything in particular. So, yeah, it was just a plaster, I guess. No healing at all.
Charles, was that kind of similar for you?
Yeah, it's funny. When you said that about control, I used to do, this sounds insane, but I used to be one for self-sabotage a lot. So it's weird, but by sabotaging yourself, it's like if I managed to get, say, 30 days clean on my own, and things would, in that quicker time, instantly get better. You know, you've got money because you're not spending it on drugs, and just generally your life sort of starts to get better very quickly. But that would make me feel really uncomfortable because I wasn't used to it. So I would always feel like something's going to go wrong soon because this is going too well. So to speed that up and be in control of it, I would intentionally fuck it up by using again and relapsing. So at least then I'm back in control because everything's fucked again, but I know why, because it was me that did it. It's a sort of byproduct of addiction itself, is like all these other areas of things that you end up doing to sort of cope with it. And then obviously you feel guilt and shame for using again, so you don't like feeling guilt and shame, so you use to change the way you feel, and then you feel guilt and shame over it, and it's just an endless thing. It's very difficult to stop.
For sure, that's so true, because you come off, you're getting symptoms that often with drug taking are opposite to the effects of the drug, and so it feels like the natural cure is just to go back to it. But even within that, you've kind of mentioned something that sounds like imposter syndrome as well, that you got so used to things going badly that you didn't trust things going well. So rather than, you know, coping with feelings of anxiety around that, it was easier to use and go back to that safe space.
Yeah, it's about familiarity, really. And yeah, it was all tied into other issues I had that with like low self-esteem and insecurity and stuff. But they were a lot of those issues were the things that were at the root of why I was using in the first place. So sort of addressing them as well as obviously stopping using was good. That was sort of the start of the recovery process again.
For sure. And we'll get into the recovery process more in a moment. So Hope, with you, where did the anorexia come from? Is it clearer looking back now where those symptoms popped up and what it was you were using that to cope with?
Yeah, so I had quite a dysfunctional family growing up, which was something that I was trying to constantly fix and try and protect everyone. I was also sexually abused for about 8 months, and I didn't want to talk about that to anyone at the time. I felt really embarrassed about it. And when it ended, I had to find a way to cope with all of those distressing things going on in my head and the fact that I hated feeling how I was feeling because I didn't want to talk about it to anyone, and because I didn't really also know how to talk about stuff like that because I was only 12. It was like this kind of weird cycle that I got into, and the anorexia just took away all of that kind of emotion, all of that pain, all of those distressing things. And the big thing for me as well was, despite giving me that control over everything around me, so I thought, it also just numbed all of those emotions. And it did mean that quite often if I ever had negative thinking around it or got upset about something, I could just switch off straight away and think about food and calories and exercise. And I loved the fact that it would just take me out of the reality of actually growing up and having to face all of this stuff that I just really, really didn't want to face.
For sure. And it's interesting within what each of you have shared, it's reminded me of a new way that I've started looking at mental illness symptoms to try and kind of understand the non-linear nature of mental illness. Often people get the wrong diagnosis, or they get worse, and that comes with a new level of diagnosis. Sometimes people have two or more conditions at once. And the way I've started trying to look at it is that the symptoms are kind of the first thing that you're using to cope with the trauma. So whatever we've been through, and sometimes it's a clear event, and sometimes it's just struggling in general. But I think speaking to people, interviewing like this, and speaking to mental health professionals, they share that so often there is something that it all traces back to. And so I've started looking at it in terms of the things you're using to cope with the trauma are often the symptoms, and then you almost collect up enough symptoms and it equals a condition. And so in that way, it kind of makes more sense that many of the conditions have symptoms that cross over. We can get misdiagnosed, or some things are less common, and so a GP may not realise that's what it is on first meeting somebody for what is often just a 10-minute appointment. So yeah, that's been something that's on my mind recently. So it's interesting to hear it's kind of reflected back. So we'll move on now to where you started getting help. So at what point did you realise something was wrong, not just in terms of the situation and you struggling, but in terms of there might be something wrong mental health wise?
So for me, I didn't think there was anything wrong with me when I went to CAMHS. So I went to CAMHS as an outpatient for about 6 months, and I didn't believe anything anyone said to me. They used a lot of shock tactics, and none of it worked on me. I then eventually got admitted to a mental health hospital and spent the first 3 days basically shouting at anyone who tried to talk to me, anyone who tried to get me to eat anything, and was on like this 24/7 supervision. And I absolutely hated it, because I thought that they were trying to take away this one thing in my life that just made everything make sense to me. But on the Friday night, so after I'd been in hospital for 3 days, one of the nurses came in to see me, and she brought with her these massive pieces of paper. She got me to draw how I imagined myself on one of these pieces of paper, and then got me to lie down on that exact same piece of paper, and she traced around the outside of me. She then got me to stand up and look back down at the paper. And the images were so, so different that I had this realization in my head that actually the way that I viewed myself was just completely distorted. And on that Friday night, whilst I didn't fully accept that I had an eating disorder, what I did accept was that my brain just viewed everything so wrong. And I basically was kind of like, I'm going to just start eating and see what will happen. And then my kind of background thoughts were like, at least if I eat, they'll let me get out of the hospital, and then I can work out what I want to do with this. But I think with eating disorders, it's just sometimes so hard to accept you need that support, because whilst it might not be caused by bad body image, that whole body image aspect gets so, so caught up in it. And for me, I needed that concrete evidence to really kind of admit that something wasn't quite right.
Right. And equally, I think from an outside perspective, that can confuse things as well, that people struggle to relate to eating disorders because the focus can be so much on the visual and like the losing weight if it's anorexia, for example. But it's only part of the story. If you're not also acknowledging the control element, all you're going to do is tell that person they're fine and they're not fat. But if they're convinced the exact opposite, it's like, I guess the comparison at the moment is our political climate. There's a lot of people having conversations from opposite sides, and they just can't see how the other side makes any sense. And I kind of imagine it a little bit like that.
Yeah, and I think it is. I think it must be. It is so frustrating if you know people who've got eating disorders and you can tell just from looking at them. But it's also really frustrating when you're in recovery and your weight seems to go up if you've got anorexia, and mentally it takes so much longer for things to catch up. And it also means you can't access services or support unless you're really underweight. And we don't, I think quite often we still think of eating disorders as very much physical illnesses because of that physical side of them, when actually they're really serious mental illnesses, and we need to be getting in there early, actually before people's weight escalates to that certain point where they have to be hospitalized.
For sure. And one more thing I wanted to mention in terms of like trying to understand the thinking behind it, because it can seem so irrational. Like that was a great example you shared about the drawing. You know, that's incredibly powerful and I think a great tool. But even still, people can go on thinking they are overweight and their body doesn't look like what it looks like. And I guess the easiest way I can translate that is in a way that we all have flaws in our minds that may not be flaws to anyone else. Like we've all had that experience where you have a spot and it's your whole face and then nobody else even notices. And then you're like going around pointing out something they wouldn't have even noticed. And that's the way I kind of see it. So there'll be, even if you're skin and bone, there's still ways that in your adult mind you can see problems and you can see fat. You know, you'll find one bit that's not even fat at all and just be like, oh well, all of this. It's like, no, that's there on everyone.
Yeah, no, and I do agree with that. And I think sometimes when you're in recovery, and we probably might talk about this in a minute in the recovery kind of focus part, but I think when you're in recovery from an eating disorder, like you have to accept that you do still have those days where your body image is so distorted. And I know that when I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror, my body image is completely different to what everyone else sees when they look at me. And I'm able to rationalize with that now and kind of talk myself out of that and look at the evidence behind it. But also to realize that actually on those days that I'm having a really bad body image day, it's actually normally because something else isn't quite right in my life. And when I say I'm having a bad body image days, there are so many other negative emotions wrapped up in that. And I think that quite often relates to so many people with eating disorders. And once you kind of narrow that down, it makes it so much easier to tackle those days.
For sure. And what about Byron?
Yeah, I think the first time I sort of thought what I was struggling with was depression was when I went to go see a psychologist for the first few times. And then once discussing through everything with him, yeah, he diagnosed me with clinical depression. Prior to that, I remember having conversations with my girlfriend who I was living with at the time, and we just kind of discussed our career and general things you normally talk about, and never once did it cross my mind that I was in any way struggling with depression or anything like that. If you had to ask me for the definition of depression, I probably wouldn't even have been able to give you an answer because I didn't know. If someone said, oh, I'm feeling anxious, I'm like, for sure. What is anxious? I don't even know what that means. Like,
and I think that happens all the time. It's always like a little bit worse than we are.
Yeah, for sure.
When we're in that stage where we're actively hiding from it.
Yeah, so my girlfriend then was like, I think you need to go speak to a psychologist because what you're saying sounds like you could do with some help. So yeah, I went through, and that was the first time when it was broken down to me and made easy to understand. I was like, okay, I see what I'm dealing with now. And yeah, it was quite refreshing, actually. As weird as it was to say, a young guy, like, oh my gosh, isn't depression just for like people who are way older, or I don't know, you just can't put it in a bracket or in a box or anything. And I had no real idea. I guess just numb, didn't really feel it.
Yeah, and you can get so used to feeling that way that it feels normal, but then
yeah.
I think for everyone there comes a point where you can't live like that anymore,
yeah.
And something has to change. And so to get a label for a lot of people can be terrifying. For me, when I was diagnosed with depression, I kind of knew that going into it. So I'd like looked up the symptoms online. There's like an NHS test that can give you, it won't diagnose you, but it'll give you a kind of indication whether or not to go to the GP. And I'd done it maybe hundreds of times, changing my answers, like downgrading it. Like, maybe I don't feel that bad on that one. And I was depressed every single time. So I really, really won that quiz. So I went into the GP knowing it. And then I thought to myself, no, I've been researching all these symptoms. I'm just going to be ready to just list them off. And then I'll just get whatever diagnosis I want. I was like, I know GPs are actually professionals and that wasn't going to happen. But in my head, I was like, no, they're just going to diagnose me because of this. So instead I went in and I was talking about like struggling to sleep, which was a big deal at the time for me and had never been in my life before. And then through that, she was able to really clearly see, okay, but where is that coming from? And that's where my diagnosis came from. But it was a major weight off for me because I was like, okay, this makes sense. I've cracked it. Now I can figure out fixing it. So last person up, Charles, what about you?
Yeah, it's funny, that moment you said of like, it's cracked and I can sort it, that didn't come. I was diagnosed with it, with depression, yeah, like 7 or 8 years ago. But it was kind of as things were starting to slide downhill for me with addiction. And I think I went to get diagnosed mainly because I wanted something to pin it on. I needed like some sort of excuse. And I think it's probably the same questionnaire you filled in, but I got given it in the doctor's. And yeah, it came back that I was depressed and I got given a box of citalopram and sort of sent them away, which I wouldn't take because I found out that they were messing up the high I would get from my drugs. So yeah, I just put them away. That moment for me came a lot more recently, like when I was in treatment for addiction. And like with addiction, the drugs aren't the cause of it. So people assume that if you take drugs, you will become addicted. But addiction is a symptom of
the drug taking.
Yeah.
I know what you're trying to say, that it may be the addiction that's causing you to keep on them to a certain extent, but there's so many other factors in that.
Yeah,
in the same way you get, you know, it's like every day at the moment, a new politician that's running for prime minister has been taking drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just kind of strangely normalised in our headlines. Again, not getting political, but something like that, you know, they're often coming from a certain background where they may have much better support systems for that to not develop into an addiction, or if it does, they're so much better supported to get out of that place.
Yeah, it's once you get into that cycle of using to stop the feelings you get from using, that's when it becomes a problem. But yeah, once I sort of got my head around what depression was, and that I think the other thing I struggled with was trying to find the reason why it was happening to me, because I feel like the sort of image that's portrayed to us a lot about mental health in general, really, is and specifically addiction as well, is that to be an addict, you must have come from a terrible background, and you must have, you know, been abused as a child and come from this trauma. It, more often than not, that is the case, but like a lot of us just, like, when I get depressed now, it just happens. It just comes from nowhere. But knowing what I know now about it and sort of the experience I've had, I know enough to just kind of ride it out and be like, this, you know, this will, it's going to come and go. Don't know when, but, you know, it's not, this is temporary, so. I'm sure it'll be
right.
Fun.
And it's one of the kind of skills from mental illness. It's you do become better at managing it. You build up that kind of resilience. You start to notice your triggers. And I often say that to people, that as much as we can get all the outside support, we always need to have a certain amount of ownership over our own recovery. Ultimately, no one else is going to know as many seconds of the day how we're feeling as we will. So next, we'll talk a little bit about challenges of recovery. So you've had your diagnosis, you're maybe coming to terms with that, you're maybe not. What kind of things may have held you back from getting support?
I think my biggest challenge in recovery was the weight change.
Right.
And when you put on weight and when you've had anorexia, but so when you have anorexia cognitively, if your BMI is a certain BMI, you can't think and you can't process things properly. And so when you start to put on weight, then cognitively your brain will start to work again. And then you get all of this like rush of emotions that you haven't had for like X amount of years, and actually having to then deal with all of those emotions, and then the challenge of putting on the weight, and then everyone commenting on it, because we live in a society where people are so fixated on diets and weight and everything like that, that when you're in recovery, you have to deal with the constant conversations about dieting, but weight, and people saying like really harmless stuff, but to you, it just is really difficult. Like when I was in recovery, people used to always talk about how healthy I looked. But as soon as you say to someone with anorexia, you look healthy, to them that means they look like a failure, that they've let themselves go. All of those kind of really negative thoughts rush through your head. So for me, the challenge was to try and keep going on those days, but to then actually talk about how I was feeling, despite the fact that physically I was looking better and I was eating. So physically, like from the outside, everyone must have just thought I was totally fixed.
Right, because if you're that entrenched in that thinking, anything will be an assault, any comment on your appearance, you'll find a way to twist round into a negative.
Yeah, it's true. I think sometimes I get in that mindset where pretty much anything anyone says about what I look like, I will turn it into a negative. And I now know that I do that, and everyone knows I do that, so it's fine. But when you're really unwell and you do that, you cannot actually get yourself out of that mindset.
Yeah, it's difficult. And that's, I think, one of the complications for anyone's recovery is how everyone else is responding to it. And so often people don't realize they're saying the wrong thing. And that's why, you know, podcasting like this, I'm so passionate about. But for all of us, I think to an extent, we had a public complication as well. There's the people in our lives, but then there's also through our work, there's people interacting with us and having certain expectations. Byron, do you mind sharing what that was like, kind of balancing recovery with also your following online and...
Oh, yeah, that's, like, one of the most frightening thoughts ever was, like, YouTube as a space, especially the kind of space I'm in, is very commercial and in line with brands, and you can't say certain things, and you have to be this kind of smiley, happy-go-lucky person so that brands can sell things through you, and, people can associate themselves with that good, branded person. And my scariest thought was, gosh, if these people who started following or watching my videos start hearing that I'm depressed and I smoke weed all the time, and I'm going to be like, gosh, I'm not that guy. This is like a complete farce, a complete lie. And I don't know, it's weird when you, with these videos, you kind of start off already being like, all right, like you've got this big smile on your face, even though you might be feeling awful. And you just have to like kind of grit through it, and you hit end, and it's like, oh my gosh, now I've got to edit this thing. Like sometimes you just feel like not doing this kind of stuff. And if that, like a lot of people are being a lot more honest about that now, but at the time especially, it was hard. So it was a frightening thought, but like even doing this kind of thing, I'd be like, are you crazy? No way.
For sure, because you're putting on an additional front.
That's
You've
it,
already got the front of I'm coping, I'm fine around people in your life, particularly when you're in that kind of denial stage we talked about. But then you've got the addition of your public as well. And you'd built a career on being funny and being relatable. And no doubt a lot of people go into your videos because of their own mental health struggles and they just want something to laugh at and distract them from.
And now they're getting some other guy saying their troubles. It's like, gosh, it's like a never-ending cycle of sadness.
But you know what? It may make such a difference to people. I'm determined to find a positive in this. I think that's great because people that have related to you in your good times should also be able to relate to you in your bad times.
Yeah.
So often we're holding public figures up to being this like narrow version of themselves. There's literally a whole documentary on Netflix now about Taylor Swift occasionally speaking about politics as this whole process, just because there can be so much pressure to just constantly be appealing and likable. And it sounds like you kind of had that barrier.
Yeah, definitely. And since talking about it and since doing things like talking about it through... Music's quite an easy thing because it's just your voice in someone's head, really, and your lyrics. And it's a lot easier to put that out there rather than doing a video where it's you and everyone can see everything. So that was probably the easiest bits was, through music at least, it felt easier. But then since doing it, these kind of things become a lot easier to talk about for sure.
Well, I guess there's that divide. You know, once you've crossed the threshold with it, then I imagine it's a lot easier.
Yeah, I think we worry about 99% of the things that just don't happen. So in my head, it was going to be this whole like, oh, he's cancelled, he's lying, when that never happened. In fact, if anything, it was the opposite. It was just people being, hey, I was the same kind of thing. And I had no idea. Even my friends, my closest friends, I made these videos with, they're like, dude, you should have said something. I was like, you should have said something. It's like... just, I don't know, a lot of silence.
I like that response. Yeah. I'm just going to start saying that to people. You should also have a podcast like this. No, that is interesting. And so was there a key turning point for you where you realized, okay, I need to speak about this stuff now?
Yes, not by choice. So we ran our first ever PR campaign with one of the album releases we were doing. And a lot of the questions were obviously, what are the songs about? And I can't lie there and be like, oh, well, it's not about depression and stuff I'm going through. I had to just be honest. So that was the first time, literally through a PR agency, which is probably the most professional way of talking about it, happened. And that was it. It's kind of like, not forced to talk about it, but had to.
Wow. But it's good to hear that it's so much easier for you now. That's certainly been my experience. I don't think I realized how much internalized stigma I had before having a podcast like this. I was always like, no, I'm the friend that talks about emotions all the time. But I was very scared of the labeling and the symptoms. And I was scared of the things that I knew I was experiencing, but I'd spent so long hiding from or not understanding that I think subconsciously I was pushing it away. I think that's a lot in what you've shared as well. There's the stigma there, that a lot of your fears were the misconceptions that are so prevalent in our society. You thought people were going to react badly. They weren't going to be interested in you anymore. They were maybe even going to feel betrayed that you have emotions other than happy and entertaining to them.
Yeah.
So Charles, do you mind sharing your challenges around recovery?
I mean, I was lucky enough to go to treatment to get treatment. For addiction.
Funnily enough,
it was amazing because it's like 3 months in a house miles from anywhere with very limited contacts with sort of friends and family. So it's easier because all the focus all the time is on recovery and therapy, but it's also really difficult because all the focus all the time is on recovery and therapy. But because of that, when I came home back to sort of normal life, back to work, gradually it felt like my brain was getting more and more full of day-to-day life and sort of distractions, that it became a lot harder to kind of have that sort of attention to my mental health that I had in treatment. You know, when I was in treatment, I was keeping like daily journals and writing gratitude lists every night and really thinking about like the 12 steps. But when you come home, suddenly it'd be weeks, and you're like, oh shit, I haven't even, you know, I haven't taken a minute to just stop and think about how I'm feeling or my behaviour, or, and then yeah, it's funny, like you said, Byron, about like crazy things that you think to yourself that are just nonsense. Like, I had a couple of weeks ago, I messaged a friend to see if he wanted to come for coffee, and he took longer than 30 seconds to reply, so obviously he hates me. And then he said, yeah, I'll meet you. And my first thought was, he doesn't really want to come. He's just doing it to do me a favour. But then if he had said no, he hates me. So I literally can't win, you know? And that's, it's good, I guess, now that I can sort of step back and go, that was mental, what you were thinking there. That's not normal. Yeah, I guess that's a challenge, is just recognising those things rather than buying into them and
right.
believing them. And it's when I get lax and do buy into it that the depression stuff usually starts. And then, you know, once you're in it, it's difficult to get back out of it. But yeah, I think just being mindful of my sort of thoughts and behaviour, I think.
For sure. And I think that's something each of you have shared a version of, that we all want to feel validated, that the outside world reflects how we're feeling. And so when we're feeling like this, it can be really easy to latch onto things. You know, if someone makes a comment about your appearance, or if someone makes a comment about how they think your recovery is going, it can be a positive thing, but it's still potentially going to be jarring. That if you're still so in the illness, then unless it confirms it, if you're feeling anxious and it's something not anxiety-inducing, you're probably not going to ignore it. And then that one thing, that one friend that hasn't texted you back as quickly, that's where all your focus is going, because that's confirming your reality. And to bring things up to a slightly more positive note then, we should talk a little bit about positives of recovery. So, you know, we've touched a little bit on the kind of the skills you can learn through it. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. I think all of us at times have become too good at presenting a mask. And we can all find those pictures in our camera roll when we were smiling in situations where we were the most unhappy. Do you guys mind sharing some of the positives you found through recovery?
Probably a couple of things. So the first thing is around just that I don't think about food all the time. So when I was really unwell, I was constantly thinking about food, constantly adding up calories, constantly getting in a state if I had to go for dinner with people. And I don't get like that anymore, which for me is like amazing that I can actually think about other things. I do also think that like recovery, the reality is it's really, really, really hard work at times. And it can feel like it's like emotionally and physically just completely exhausting. But actually, I know from the fact that I've been through it, and like I am still in an ongoing state of recovery, but I know that where I'm at is just so much better than where I've ever been. And it just feels amazing. And I think quite often, particularly like I do a lot of work in hospitals with people who are really unwell, and actually getting them to understand that at some point you can get to a place where it can be really good again. And I think that's something that for me I've just realized over the last couple of years. And you get to do all of this stuff that you never thought you'd get to do, like go traveling or, I don't know, go out with your friends last minute.
Write a book.
Yeah, write a book. Everything like that you can actually do. And I think that's like just really exciting. And I think sometimes when you're in like just feeling so rubbish about stuff, it's about actually thinking about all of those amazing things that you could do if you got to that place in recovery. And then you can push yourself a little bit further all the time to actually get to a place where you can achieve all of that stuff.
Right, for sure, because that's the upside, that whilst you can go to dark places you may not have even realized existed, there can even be a positive in that. You know, sometimes I look back at the times when I've been my worst and I realize how far I've come. And it also, in a way, is a kind of motivator to keep putting in that hard work you've described. But on the flip side of that, there's all you learn in terms of how great things can be.
Yeah.
How much you can recover, how resilient you can be.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think quite often, like, we do like look at kind of an eating disorder and like it's terrible when you have an eating disorder. It really sucks. It's absolutely rubbish. But there are loads of positives that you can get out of it. And I'm not saying go and develop an eating disorder so you get all those things.
Yeah, not
actually,
recommended.
No. But actually, like, you have like a different kind of empathy. You have a different, I don't know, you can relate to people on a different level. And I think sometimes we do just look at the negatives around it and get like really unhappy about it. But there are so many strengths that you can get off the back of recovery. And I think sometimes it is about taking that step back and actually looking at all of those strengths that you might now have.
Absolutely. And one kind of miscellaneous strength I've found with it is I can now just spot eating disorders in other people. It's like instinctual. It's a weird kind of skill because I don't really want it. Often I don't want to be reminded of things I've struggled with, but it can be really great for seeing symptoms in friends who were hiding from it in the way I used to hide from it, and potentially I can kind of nudge them towards the awareness. Yeah,
no, and
the
definitely
support.
And it means that having been through something, we can, I feel like we have a right to have a direct conversation with people about it and be more blunt about things than maybe someone else who hasn't been through something has.
Right, we're not going to tiptoe around it in the same way. We can still say the wrong thing, but yeah. Byron, do you want to share anything?
Yeah, sure. I think I've always been quite a closed book person, so in terms of talking about this kind of stuff, especially with my family, I don't know, whenever I used to see my mother, it was always quite hard because it would be like the elephants in the room kind of thing that, like, please don't bring up, like, how I'm doing with, like, my dad's death and stuff. So that would, yeah, it would hang over me all the time, and I think that affected my relationship with my mother in particular and my siblings as well, because my brother's kind of similar to me. So in terms of conversation like that, it would just be, we just wouldn't ever go there. But recently, yeah, things have been much more improved. I mean, last time I went to go visit my mother back in South Africa, we were going through photo albums and things like that, which is nice. It makes me feel like, I don't know, weird to say, but like part of the family again, even though I kind of subjected myself or secluded myself rather on my own doing. So yeah, in terms of being able to just speak freely with my family, I think has been the most beneficial part of the whole recovery process.
Yeah, that's lovely to hear because that's part of your history, your dad. That's a fundamental part of who you are. And so to be in a household where he's not talked about must be incredibly hard.
Yeah, it was just weird. And I knew it was weird, and everyone else knew it was weird. And my mom would be like, why don't we ever talk about it? And I'd be like, oh, I wouldn't even give an answer. Just kind of exhale until she stopped talking about it. And then, yeah, so it's not like that anymore. It's definitely been some improvements. Obviously, it's still awkward at times. I don't know why, but just how it is.
Yeah, it's difficult, but what I'm going to take from that is the importance of honesty.
Yeah.
That in a way, I think going through mental illness can bring you to a new level of honesty, a new level of being able to talk about feelings and really talk about them, how you're actually feeling, not the usual I'm fine. Like I don't trust, if anyone says I'm fine to me, I'm like, that's automated. That's never, I don't think anyone's ever fine. Yeah. We're always something. But also, not just honesty in terms of how you express yourself, but honesty in your relationships. And it sounds like that's what you really drifted from with your mother, that by not talking about this, you're not talking about a major part of what you're both going through.
Yeah. And then also the coping mechanisms, obviously the last, or can't speak for every mother, but I'm sure most mothers don't want to hear that their son is doing, I don't know, all sorts of things just to stay cool. So yeah, in terms of opening up with her about that kind of stuff, there were some heartbreaking conversations, but was highly beneficial in the long run. And I realized that my mother understands these things, like all mothers do, a lot more than you'd expect. And it wasn't so much the getting shunned, more just the, hey, you should have just told me from the start kind of thing. So honesty in all aspects of my life has been improved upon, especially on a family level.
Brilliant. And Charles?
Yeah, I agree 100% with the honesty thing. It's like that quote.
I realise we've given you the hard job by you answering last. You
no, it's great because these two go and I'm just like, oh, that's a good one. I'll pick up on it.
I'm going to brand that as my own.
Yeah. Can't remember who quote's attributed to. It might be Winston Churchill, but an honest man never has to remember what he said. So if you're open and honest about everything, then you don't have the added pressure of like keeping track of all these pretenses you're keeping up, and who have I told them all right, and who have I not, you know, who can, who can't know. So yeah, it just makes it so much easier if everyone knows
right.
the score.
And I think particularly with addiction as a condition,
yeah.
there's an additional layer there because you've got the potentially putting up a front, hiding symptoms, pretending you're having a better day than you are anyway. But then also that stuff is integral to the addiction continuing. So yeah. it's not just that you're pretending you're okay, you're also pretending you're okay so you can keep using.
Yeah, I mean, it's I have to be very careful with it. It can be a slippery slope because, like, I don't even tell white lies anymore, you know, because my brain will tell me, if I tell a lie and I get away with it, my brain will be nudging me going, like, what else, you know, you could go and have a drink and lie about it, you know. Do anything. So I just have to be careful not to do that. But in terms of positives, like for me personally, I think just knowing, being able to say with conviction like who I am and what I'm passionate about, what I care about, what my sort of values are. When I first got into treatment and we had to fill this worksheet out, one of the questions was, can you explain how your morals, beliefs and values have changed as a result of your using? And I couldn't answer it because I couldn't remember a time when I had morals or beliefs. I was like, I don't know. So sort of rebuilding that, which I guess is a personality, having like a personality again and liking that person as well, not just knowing sort of who you are, but actually liking that.
Yeah, because I remember when I interviewed you before, you shared something like that about how...
Probably said exactly the same thing.
I love it though. So you were one of our first ever interviews, and it still remains one of my all-time favourites. We've not actually covered addiction since because, well...
It's too depressing.
Well, we've covered it with other things, but I'm like, how do we top what you said? But that's so right that you can lose yourself in these struggles. You cross so many boundaries you thought you'd never cross. And then you're also trying to create this fake persona. Like you said, you have to remember all the lies. And so you can lose who you actually are in all of that. And then you just have to rebuild yourself as a personality in addition to rebuilding the rest of your life.
Yeah, the crossing the boundaries thing is a big one. Like when I started using it, like recreationally, I was very aware that like this could get out of control. So I'd set these boundaries, like I won't pay for it myself. I'll only do it on the weekend. I won't bring it home. And gradually those got crossed off. So once I'd crossed all of those, it was like there was, you know, there was nothing else. I might as well just do, you know, anything I would not have done before. It's like, well, you know, sort of open season sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you feel that you've been able to reestablish those boundaries now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, don't know how. I think it's just like a case of like when I came home from treatment, I had 3 months clean and sober. So it's like keeping that going. And definitely within the first year, I had to be very careful about like going to the pub and sort of being around people that were drinking and just being mindful that like I might need to go and sit somewhere on my own for a bit. And people that I was around knew that and were fine with it. So that's the sort of honesty thing coming in again, you know. It's right. Dangerous and sort of risky to be like, oh no, it's, you know, I'm fine if you're really not fine. It can come across like you're being overprotective of yourself, but you just have to sort of look after yourself and be safe, be as safe as possible with sort of what you do, where you go and who you go there with.
For sure, because it's like I said earlier, you have to have ownership in this ultimately, and I think we've all had experiences of that, having to learn what your triggers are. It's a process you can only really go through primarily by yourself. As much support as you can have from the outside world, your internal processes, you just have to become the expert on eventually. So we are running out of time, sadly. We'll need to start wrapping up. If people have listened to this and connected to your experience, is there a final message each of you would like to share about recovery? By all means, be as inspirational as you want, and I'll just sit here and grin at you. Byron, go first.
Oh, I knew that was going to happen. My inspirational quote is, it's cool to talk about this stuff. You're not going to be labeled a loser or anything like that.
See, Byron's so cool. Look at
him. No, I can't say there'll be zero backlash because then you'll hold me to it, but no, I'm pretty sure there won't be any. I mean, yeah, just talk about the stuff. It really does help. Yeah.
Right.
No matter how much of a closed book you are, just find the person you're the most open with and chat to them.
Yeah.
Just get talking, whoever it is, and then, yeah, take it from there.
For sure, because you'll find time and time again the exact things you were worrying about can be far more a reflection of the mental illness and the symptoms of that than the actual reality of how people will react. And Charles, you ready?
Yeah, I kind of want to share something for not necessarily people that do suffer with mental health, but people, I mean, I would say everyone knows someone who, you know, they know struggle from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And something that annoys me is when it's like Mental Health Day or Mental Health Awareness Day, you see a lot of people sharing on social media, anyone, you know, speak to me anytime if you're struggling. To me, that's useless because sometimes like, it's a great thing to say, but when people are struggling, the last thing you want to do is reach out and speak to anyone. It's the hardest thing to do. So I would say, if you know someone that's expressed to you in the past that they've struggled, or someone close to you that you recognise something in, then you need to be the one to reach out to them and check in with them occasionally. You know, just a message once a week. You know, if you haven't seen them for a while, just check in, see if they're all right, invite them somewhere. I think for me specifically as well, again, with regards to addiction, I lost probably about 60% of my contact list in terms of people that I used to hear from regularly. I don't get invited anywhere anymore because I don't know if it's people trying to keep me safe or assuming that I'm not fun anymore. But just try and keep contact with those people. Instead of putting the thing on them to, like, well, if you're struggling, come to me and I'm happy to talk about it, that's great. But you should be the one extending the invitation if you feel that strongly about it.
Yeah.
I guess on the flip side, if you are someone that's struggling, try and feel like you can reach out to people and that it's not a taboo subject anymore and it's getting less and less so. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah, I love that. I guess my version of that would be that I can be quite intense, and as you'd imagine with a show like this, I really want to fix things. I really want to learn something from it. I want a lesson. So I've had to, you know, try and kind of taper that. And so often me reaching out, if I know someone's really struggling and they're kind of not ready for the type of support I'm good at, I'll just spend time with them. And I think that goes both ways. If you're struggling, spend time with someone and just be in their presence, because it's harder to suffer in company. And if you are someone that's worried about a friend, maybe they need a conversation, maybe they need a bit of encouragement to get support, but sometimes you being around and you keeping them company is enough to stop them going a bit lower.
Yeah. Definitely.
While they figure things out.
Definitely.
Okay. And last up, Hope.
So I think my thing is, and it always sounds, I always feel like it's a bit like cheesy when you say it, but I do think, like, on those really, really rubbish days, like, I have a list of 20 things that I try and do on those days. And sometimes I only end up doing one of them. Sometimes I do all 20. And it's things like, I always wash my hair. I always make myself get out of bed. I always go for a walk or go and get a coffee or something like that. If it's nice weather, I'll sit in the sunshine. And on those days when you have a really, really bad day, I have to remind myself that it's not a weak thing, that it's okay. And remembering that those feelings pass and eventually you will get through that day and it gets better and then you can start again the next day. And I think with that, it's about taking that time for yourself. And I probably am like the worst person to give advice on taking time for yourself, because I, yeah, barely ever do it. But actually this week on Thursday, I went to Brighton to do some work for the day and I had a really bad morning. Yeah, basically just it was awful and wasn't in the best headspace. And when I got to Brighton, I was supposed to go and to this conference and speak, and in kind of, I missed the networking part of the conference because I just felt so rubbish. I just wanted to take time for myself, and I sat on the beach and it was such a nice day, and I felt really guilty when I was sitting on the beach, but then actually it put me in that better headspace. And I think it's so, so important that whether you have had a diagnosable mental illness or whether you're just someone with, because we all have mental health, it's about actually working out what we need on a day-to-day basis. And actually we need to be okay with sitting with those feelings and taking that time for ourselves.
Right. I love that. I've definitely got that in common with you. For me, I've had to get a lot better at forgiving myself, that I set such a high bar for productivity that the days where I feel I can't get out of bed, because that still happens.
Yeah.
It's not every day anymore, and that's the change, but it still can happen. I'll forgive myself for, I want to take another hour, and that's okay, and I can still figure it out. And it's better I do that than force myself out and have a truly shitty day.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Right, so we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for being part of the episode today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. No likes. Fuck. Maybe the filter wasn't different enough, or maybe I didn't tag it right. Nothing's coming up, no alerts, no saves, nobody's got in touch.
it's a lie, repackaged as a dream, distributed like a drug, lying scattered on your screen. We breed it in the scenes that we read about daily. Suicide kids being raised by a baby, slaves to the gram. Ironic that we call it that, it's faster than a dealer and you never need to call it back. Everyone's a movie star, everybody's famous, everybody's innocent, everybody's blameless. But not the habits of advertising execs, the targets that are set by what we're taught to accept. And you're surprised when it's you that they're selling, the worst monster, that's the one that you let in. It's too late for me, I'm caught in it. I keep watching the days go by, I keep sleeping, I don't feel right. No likes, no likes, it's too late for me, I'm caught in it. I keep watching the days go by, I keep sleeping, I don't feel right. But what about me? Well, I'm caught in it too. Energy getting sapped. I resort to the blue and the green coloured apps. I need validation. I need candy state and nobody's got the love and can't see the way we're facing. Negativity, it feeds mental illnesses. We don't feel this and that's what a mental illness is. So wake up to what's keeping you asleep. Assessing how you're living by what's happened in a week. Your kids are finding it harder to break from it. You can make excuses, the truth is that you made them want it. When you put that iPad in that pushchair and replaced every high dad with a shush there, you left it to the internet to raise him on a viral feed. I wonder why a 5-year-old has got anxiety. I'm glad I grew up when it was in its infancy, cause now I see what to teach an infant not to be. It's too late for me, I'm caught in it. I keep watching the days go by, I keep sleeping, I don't feel right. No likes, nah, no likes. It's too late for me, I'm caught in it. I keep watching the days go by, I keep sleeping, I don't feel right. No likes, nah, no likes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.